Thank you for giving up your lunch hour to hear me address this question of agnosticism. As the joke goes, I used to be agnostic, but now I'm not so sure. It's good to have you here. Now, of course, most people know what agnosticism means. It just comes from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge, or gnosko, meaning to know, and it's the negation of that, the opposite of knowledge. But people do mean different things by the term. For some people, it might just mean that I haven't looked into something enough to know the answer. I think it could be looked into, I just haven't looked into it. So I could say, I'm agnostic about the role of the inferior colliculus in the integration of auditory and spatial and auditory and visual information with respect to spatial position. I am agnostic about that. About 12 years ago, I did some research in that kind of stuff, was quite interested in it, haven't kept abreast of the literature, and I just don't know what the latest findings are. I could find out if I wanted to, could go to the library. If people haven't done enough yet, I could do some more experiments, but I just don't know at the moment. So maybe you're agnostic in that sense about questions of Christianity. You could know, but you just haven't done the research yet. And if that's you, I'd love to encourage you to look into it a bit more. But other people use the term agnostic in a more absolute sense to mean I don't think it would be possible to know. There's no point in looking into Christianity because by definition, it's unknowable whether or not it's true. The trouble with that definition is it starts to sound actually not very agnostic at all about itself. So to paraphrase, I know that you can't know. It's actually a very absolute, certain claim to knowledge. And absolute negations of that kind are very difficult to support philosophically. There's something like it in mathematics, I guess, with Gödel's theorem. But in other areas of knowledge, really, unless you know absolutely everything that anyone has known in the world, it's very difficult to be confident about a negative. Only if you researched everything about Christianity more than anyone else would you be able to say that kind of thing. I don't think anyone here is in that position. But there is a third way in which people use agnosticism, and it's really not so much a definition as a kind of practice or an idea. And the idea is that I don't really want to know. So I use agnosticism as a label to get me out of awkward conversations with Christians and to stop having to engage with it. As I say, not so much a stance as a game to play to avoid a stance. I don't want to be hassled with this, so I'll call myself agnostic. I remember years ago when I was at Bible college, one particularly inspirational lecture that I still remember, even without looking up the notes. And it began like this. My doctrine lecturer came into the lecture hall, stood at the front of the room and said, the world is flat, convince me otherwise. And then folded his arms and waited. And we thought, well, this will be pretty easy. So someone said straight away, hand up, it looks round from space. That's a fairly good first argument. He said, oh yes, well, everyone knows, NASA, they faked the photographs. Have you seen it? No, okay. Somebody else who's a physicist said something about the gravitational field or the electronic field or something like that. And he said, oh no, you're just trying to bamboozle me with science. How can I possibly know whether that's right or not? And so it went on for about 10 minutes of people getting more and more exasperated with more and more convincing arguments that the world was round, which met with, you know, being battered away in the same manner. And then finally, we realized the game that he was playing. Because he wasn't actually trying to find out the shape of the world. He was just trying to avoid engagement with the arguments. And of course, you can always get out of any argument. You can always be slightly more skeptical than the answer is. Anyone who's got a four-year-old niece or godson or something knows that. You know, the kid who asks why, and you think, okay, fair enough, and you answer. And they ask why again, and you want to applaud them for their philosophical insight at wanting to get to the very basics of things. And then so you answer again, and then even when you get down to rock bottom premises, they still ask why, and you realize they're just four, and it was just the game they were playing, and you look a bit stupid for having played it. But it's always easy if you want to be a skeptic to win. The skeptic always wins. The skeptic never arrives at the truth, but that's not the game that the skeptic's playing. The skeptic is trying to avoid engagement with the truth so that they won't have to. Always easy to be more cynical than whatever piece of evidence is offered you. I want to ask you, just at the beginning of this lunchtime, I've called it the skepticism test, just to ask yourself this question in order to work out whether you're playing that game. Are you doing everything that you can do to find out whether this is true? Whether Jesus Christ is God, whether he made us, whether he'll be our judge in the future on Judgment Day, whether we need to be saved. You may not know about that. You may be agnostic in the first sense, haven't looked into it. But are you doing everything that you can to look into it? The reading you can, the questioning of friends that you can, the thinking hard about it that you can. Or is I don't know for you just a way of shelving it? I don't want to know, so I'll say I don't know. Well, I know that sometimes it can be that game because it was a game that I used to play for years, actually. I remember somebody saying to me once, a much cleverer friend than I am, he said, I don't remember ever losing an argument about Christianity as a non-Christian. I always won. It's easy to win an argument if you don't care about the answer. You just move the goalposts until you win. I always won. The one thing I could never understand about these Christians is why, having lost the argument, they came back the next day maintaining exactly the same position, which, as an experienced arguer, I knew that you never did. Well, I used to play that kind of game, and the reason was not that I thought Christianity was false. I think I genuinely didn't know. But I didn't want it to be true. I had this hunch that Jesus, if I followed him, would wreck my life. I was at university. I had all kinds of plans for my social life and my future. I thought Christianity would cramp my style. I thought it would make me a kind of grey person. I thought it would stop me doing all kinds of things I fully intended to do. And so I didn't want the inconvenience of a God to whom I was answerable. Or absolute truth to which I must adhere. So I avoided it. I don't know if there's anyone like that here. Maybe there isn't, because the one thing an I don't know hiding person doesn't ever do is come to talk like this. At least I never did. I always used to arrange an essay crisis for the library. In my day in Cambridge, it was Sunday nights that they had these kind of talks. So I always made sure I was doing physiology in the library on Sunday evening, to avoid the invitation. Well, if you've come, thank you for that. Well done, at least, for coming. But it's easy to hide, and of course you'll want to hide, so long as you think that Christianity will wreck your life. What I want to do in these next minutes is, firstly, persuade you, if you're agnostic in sense one, that it's worth looking into. If you're agnostic in sense two, I think it's, frankly, absurd to be absolutely sure that you can't know. But if you're agnostic in sense three, it's just a kind of game to keep it at arm's length. I want to persuade you, firstly, that's not a very sensible or safe thing to do, but also it's not something you should even want to do, because Christianity won't wreck your life and is actually a wonderful thing. Well, enough by way of preamble. I want to speak to you from a little excerpt from the New Testament, which you've got printed on your on the little piece of paper on your seats, and I'd be grateful if you could follow that, because most of what I say is going to come from this. This is John's first letter. So John, one of the apostles, one of Jesus' closest friends, writing a letter to Christians in the first century about his experiences. And my first point will be this: the truth is a historical person. There's no need to be agnostic. At the beginning of John's letter, he writes this: that which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we've looked at, and our hands have touched, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. The life appeared, we've seen it and testified to it. We proclaim to you the eternal life which was with the Father and has appeared to us. We proclaim to you what we have seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. And our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete. Seems to me this is one of the most extraordinary paragraphs in the whole of the New Testament, because it combines two things that by themselves are quite unexceptional in an absolutely extraordinary way. Two unexceptional things. Firstly, discussion of the biggest philosophical questions of life. He begins that which was from the beginning. So questions of origins. Where do we come from? You know, almost every week, even in the Metro, not the most highbrow of newspapers, there's some discussion about the, you know, the latest insights in the Big Bang Theory as it's developed, or questions about human ancestors, or something like that. So that's pretty unexceptional to talk about human origins, or to talk about life. What is the essence of life? What is human flourishing? Again, that's pretty unexceptional. You go to any art gallery in London, and you'll find modern artists grappling with these kind of questions. What is beauty? What is life? What is death? What is personality? Again, for people to philosophize, I guess in Oxford, it's pretty normal. The other thing he does that's pretty unexceptional is to explain things that happened to him, like a kind of dear diary when you're 14 and you write about your day. You know, this morning I went to Costa, which I did. I was going to go to McDonald's for McDonald's breakfast. My conscience got the better of me, and I thought I'll go to Costa and have a kind of refined Oxford breakfast. So I had a panini and a coffee with a nice latte art fern drawn in the front, in the top of it with the milk. And I met a guy with a hat who was walking past. Ordinary, pretty boring morning. But the extraordinary thing about this paragraph is that those two categories get combined. The hugest philosophical questions we might ever face: what is life, where do we come from, where are we going, what's reality, and stuff that happened in John's day. That which was from the beginning, he says, we heard, we saw, we touched. The life, he says, we saw it. We testify to it. These enormous philosophical questions, the truth is a person, and we met him. Of course, the claim he's getting at is that the God who made this world 2,000 years ago in Israel, Palestine, under the Roman occupation, was born as a human being and walked around the streets. So if you lived in Jerusalem in the first century, like in Oxford, you'd have walked past somebody with a hat. Somebody else would have sold you your copy of the Metro. You'd have bought a bus ticket off somebody else. And then walking past you in the raincoat was the guy who made the universe. And that is an absolutely extraordinary thing to say, isn't it? That just within his everyday life, he encountered the answer to all of philosophy. But that's his claim. The truth is a person, a historical person. There's no need to be agnostic. Because John, he says he was an eyewitness, actually not just an eyewitness, but an ear witness and a touch witness of these events. Some things happened within John's lifetime that he saw that persuaded him that he had met God. And he was an eyewitness of those things. Now, you can go away and read his account, John's Gospel, of some of the things that he saw that persuaded him that he was dealing with ultimate truth and he'd met God. And I'd love you to do that. Unfortunately, due to my failure to plan far enough ahead, we haven't got John's account for you on your seats. We've got Mark's account, also worth reading. Please read that. John's account you can find very easily in a bookshop if you're resourceful, or on the internet. He gives the account of the things that persuaded him. And I reckon there's an allusion to one of the most famous scenes in his account, even just here in the first sentence. That which we've heard, which we've seen with our eyes, which we've looked upon and touched with our hands. You might remember the story of Doubting Thomas, so-called. So it's at the end of John's account. Jesus has been executed on a Roman cross under Pontius Pilate, the governor. And then 3 days later, persuades many of his followers that he's alive again. They meet him face to face. And they tell this to Thomas, one of the apostles, and he says, look, this is ridiculous. You know, I know enough about biology to know that if you die, that's it. And the claim wasn't that Jesus was living on in some kind of, you know, philosophical sense, like the memory of him lives on. The claim was he was actually living on in a flesh and blood way. And he said, this is ridiculous. You know, I know that when you die, you die. I can't believe that he's back from the dead unless I myself see him and unless I put my finger in the marks where they put the nails when they crucified him. It's actually a very good bit of evidence, isn't it? That would be, because if you can touch the nail marks of the crucifixion, then firstly you verify that the guy's alive again, because normally if you touch people you can be pretty sure if they're alive. But also you can check that the person who's alive is the same person that they killed, because you're examining the execution scars. Thomas says, that's the kind of evidence I would need to believe something like a resurrection. I'd need to know he died, and I'd need to know firsthand that he was alive again. Well, you may know the story. Jesus appeared to Thomas and said, put your hands here in my side and in the nail marks. Stop doubting and believe. You might call him Thomas the agnostic, but after that encounter, he wasn't agnostic, quite reasonably. He knew, because he had first-hand touch witness. I think there's an allusion to that here, that which we looked at and our hands have touched. How could John forget that piece of evidence before his eyes of what he had encountered? And so because the truth is a matter of history, because he was a person that was met, there's no need to be agnostic anymore. If someone just shares with you a philosophy, Christianity is a philosophy, you think, well, that's interesting, sounds nice. How do I know it's right? Here are many other philosophies. If it was just a kind of lifestyle, here's a lifestyle that some people live and they recommend it to you, it's a great way to live, you think, well, fair enough, but I know other people who are Buddhists and they seem to have a good life as well. How do I know that you're right? If it was just an ethic, how would you know it was the best? But if it's a person, becomes a much more objective category, doesn't it? Was this person really there? Did he really live? Did he really do this? What actually happened? It's a very objectively checkable kind of thing. And here's the argument. The people who met him weren't agnostic. Now, I know you might be, but if you said to Thomas, I wonder how sure you are about life, he'd say, I'm very sure. Isn't there even a bit of doubt? Thomas, how can you be absolutely sure? Isn't there a bit of doubt? He says, there's no doubt at all, because I actually met him. Wasn't a vague thing. You know, I thought the person walking past me on the street looked a bit shiny. Maybe it was God. It's not like that. I spent 3 years with this man. I saw many of the things he did. I followed him closely. I watched him be executed, and I saw him alive again, and I touched his alive body. I'm sure, he'd say. And because he was sure, we can be sure. Now, someone might object, but this is no good because I want first-hand evidence. You're asking me to believe something on the basis of what somebody else saw. That's not good enough for me. Well, let me say two things about that. Firstly, it is good enough for the country that you live in to decide your future. About a year and a half ago now, I was arrested in London, carted off in a police car, cautioned. And the reason was I was assaulted in the street. I was on my bike. There was a road rage thing with a van. The van driver overtook me, got out the van, pushed me onto the floor. And I thought he was about to beat me up. And fortunately, a pedestrian intervened. And we called the police. And I said, I've just been assaulted. And he said, I've just been assaulted. So they arrested both of us and took us off to the police station. It's slightly embarrassing. It was on a Sunday. I was due in church quite soon afterwards. Had to phone someone from church saying, I'm sorry, I can't be there. I've been arrested. Yeah, it makes things interesting, doesn't it, when your vicar is at the police station in a cell. And but I actually got released about an hour later, and he got charged and then found guilty in court. And the reason was there were eyewitnesses there. What somebody else saw was sufficient to secure my freedom and his conviction. And it's the same for you. You know, a jury could sentence you to life imprisonment even though none of them watched you stab him. As long as there were witnesses and they were reliable and they testified to it, that would be enough. So before we're kind of sniffy about second-hand eyewitness evidence, just realise that you live in a culture which takes that kind of evidence very seriously, and I think rightly so. But also, measure it by this criterion. I think people do die for things that are a lie. Of course they do. False causes, terrible causes, people will die for. Flying a plane into a tower for the sake of a hope of a paradise of virgins. People will die for a lie, but I don't think you'll find many people who would die for something that they know is a lie. In other words, the people who die for the cause are usually pretty convinced by the cause themselves. Here's the key thing about these eyewitnesses. Not only are they prepared to die for it, meaning they're convinced by it, but they're also in a position absolutely to know whether it's right. The people who were able to know did know. And that's, I think, evident by the behaviour and their willingness to testify to it. They were sure, and so we can be sure. There's no need to be agnostic. In fact, actually, agnosticism, after that kind of act of revelation by God in history, would be slightly bizarre, wouldn't it? I mean, having actually met him, be a bit odd, wouldn't it, to be agnostic still? Let's imagine the speculation in Oriel about whether this bloke called Andrew Satch exists. You know, so someone says, I heard it's rumoured that there's this vicar somewhere in London who got arrested last year, who used to be a neuroscientist, is now a vicar, and likes wearing green. And someone says, oh, I don't know, I've heard that rumour too, but it might not be true. Could just be made up, you know. Anyway, and then you come to this lunchtime, here I am, okay, this is me, I'm Andrew Satch, I'm wearing green. And then you go back to Oriel and you say, oh, Andrew Satch, not really sure, I mean, he might exist. And that would be strange, wouldn't it? Agnosticism before the event, fair enough, but now, slightly perverse, actually, having actually met me. Now, I'm sure there isn't any speculation about whether I exist, because that's not very important. But the question of whether there's a God, John is no longer agnostic about it. Thomas isn't agnostic. He's absolutely sure. You would be, wouldn't you, if you'd been there and touched him? Well, because he's sure, we can be sure. But then finally on this first point, I've got 2 points. Finally on this first point, they were happy as well as sure. Just look down again at the end of the paragraph. We proclaim to you what we've seen and heard, so that you also may have fellowship with us. Our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. We write this to make our joy complete. He says, in other words, it's not just that I now know more about abstract philosophy than I once did. I've got some answers to big questions and I didn't know them before. He's got more to share than that. He says, I've now got fellowship, that's friendship, with the God who made me. What an extraordinary thing to say. I am now in a loving friendship with my Creator. And so can you be. And that's why I'm very, very excited to tell you about it, says John. You see, John's experience of having met God was not that it wrecked his life. Now, I used to live in a carefree existence, then I met my Creator. What a drag. Now I've got to go to church endlessly, you know, and listen to organ music or something. No, here is a fantastic, fantastic thing I've discovered. And I'm rejoicing in it, and I would love you to know. And so that would make my joy complete. I don't think you'll find a Christian in Oxford, a real Christian, who will tell you that following Jesus has been easy. I think every Christian will say it's had trials and struggles. But I'm also sure that you won't find any real Christian who will tell you they'd swap it for anything. Being a Christian doesn't wreck your life. And so there's no need to hide. Why would you want to hide from something that's this good news? There we are. Firstly, the truth is a historical person. There's no need to be agnostic. In fact, it would be slightly perverse to be agnostic after this kind of revelation. Secondly, more briefly, the truth offers salvation. It is dangerous to be agnostic. Truth offers salvation. It's dangerous to be agnostic. So look at verse 5, second paragraph. Here is a summary of the Christian message as John received it from Jesus Christ, who he was convinced was God. So this is God's take on Christianity. Here is the message we heard from him and declare to you, just 11 words, God is light, in him there is no darkness at all. You want to summarize the very essence of Christianity? God is light, in him there is no darkness at all. In other words, the truth about God is very different from that offered by the Eastern religions, known as monism, monistic religions, or the yin-yang religions. You know the symbol, the yin-yang symbol, where with the kind of spiral where the black bit blends into the white bit and the white bit blends into the black, and there's a dot of white in the middle of black and a a dot of black in the middle of white. And it's as if to say, black and white, good and evil, truth and falsehood, they're both really one. They're part of the same thing. One becomes the other is the same as that. Good and evil is all one. God is one, you are God, God is you, God is the chair is God, everything's part of one. And immediately John says, no, I discovered that wasn't true. God isn't a mixture, God is light only. And in him is no darkness at all. So God is only light and not darkness. God is only truth. One of the reasons that's one of the ways the metaphor of light is used by John. He's only truth and no falsehood. He's only good. That's another way that he uses the metaphor of light. He's only good, no evil. He's only just, no moral compromise. Only good. That's God. But if that is true about God, if that is the ultimate reality about God, then there's a problem. Because none of us are unmixed light in that kind of way. None of us are only good, only true, only just. All of us are quite morally compromised. I certainly am. I very much suspect you are the same. And that's a problem. Back home in my house in London, I've got a 40-watt bulb in the bathroom. So it's a kind of pretty dim bulb. And let me tell you, I look fantastic in 40 watts in the mornings, okay? But then I went to stay in this hotel recently, and they had these kind of super bright halogen lights, and they must have been about, 5 kilowatts or something. Turn the lights on, and absolutely everything showed, all my blackheads and the wrinkles, and I looked pretty disgusting, actually, close up in the mirror. And I thought, why would people with lots of money want to install good lighting in their bathroom? 40 watts is the way to go. And so if the standard, against the standard of, some of my friends or some people in London, I can say I'm quite a good bloke. I'm a better bloke than some people who live around me, who I guess there's quite a lot of domestic violence in the East End of London. So the statistics tell me I don't do that. So I'm a better bloke than them. So if I just compare myself in a kind of 40 watt way with other people, I do okay. But if I were to compare myself with a God who was totally good, then I wouldn't be okay. And in fact, that is why Jesus, even though he was a wonderful, loving, compassionate, kind, true person, was often quite awkward to be around. You read the accounts of Jesus, you'll find that people found him difficult to be with, not because he wasn't good, but precisely because he was good. People found themselves shown up by him, exposed by him. They didn't like it very much. He was always pointing out hypocrisy in others, injustice, selfishness, lying. And John says, look, if God is light, and yet in us there's darkness, there's a problem. Look at how he goes on to speak. Verse 6, if we claim to have fellowship with him and yet walk in the darkness, we lie and we don't live out the truth. But if we walk in the light as he is in the light, we have fellowship with one another. The blood of Jesus purifies from all sin. If we claim to be without sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. I think he says the same thing three different ways. If we are in the darkness and we say we're friends with him in the light, we're lying. If we say we're not in the darkness, we're lying. We deceive ourselves. And then finally, if we claim we have not sinned, we make him a liar. If I say I'm a bit morally mixed, and God's a bit morally better, but that's okay. I think that'll be fine. I think, if I were to meet God on Judgment Day, he'd be okay with me like this. John says someone's lying. Either I'm lying, I'm just self-deceived, or he's lying. But actually, if he's right, God is light, there's no darkness at all in him, then there's a problem. If I deny the problem, I'm deceived. There is a problem, but there is a wonderful solution. If we walk in the light, we have fellowship with one another, and the blood of Jesus, his son, purifies us or cleanses us from all sin. Verse 9, if we confess our sins, he's faithful and just and will forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. And then verse 2, Jesus is the atoning sacrifice for our sins, the one who died so that I would not face God's judgment. Not only for ours, but also the sins of the whole world. Here is a problem, And yet here is a wonderful solution. Jesus died to cleanse me so that I could come into the light and live with God. That's the Christian message, very basically, as John received it from the one he was convinced was God. But the thing about a diagnosis of something very serious and the treatment for it is it's quite difficult to be agnostic about it. John says there's the problem, really serious problem, but here's a solution. Jesus died for you. It's difficult to find the agnostic path there. So let me give you an analogy. Recently, in our church, a lady who works in the city, she's not very much older than me, in her mid-40s, has been diagnosed with cancer. She had sciatica, kind of dead leg kind of thing, pain in her leg, and went to the doctor about it, and they discovered that at the base of her spine, she has some kind of tumour growing. And she's waiting on tests at the moment. She had a biopsy last week. Test results due in tomorrow. Now, let's imagine she goes to the doctor, and the doctor says one of the possibilities is it's going to be breast cancer, secondaries on her spine. They say it's breast cancer, and you need chemotherapy, and this is the chemotherapy we advise, and you need to start tomorrow. And then she says, I don't really like that idea, but she goes and sees another doctor. Maybe she goes to a kind of alternative doctor or something, and the other doctor says, oh, no, you're okay, actually. All you need is a bit of osteopathy on your spine, and you'll be fine. Now, where is the agnostic position with respect to those diagnoses? Okay, one person says you're in trouble, it's very serious, you've got cancer, you need chemotherapy. The other person says you're not in trouble, it's fine, you just need osteopathy. What do you do as an agnostic? Because it seems to me there's not a neutral position between those two. Either you take chemotherapy or you don't. And so just to defer the decision is the same as deciding that you haven't got cancer, actually. Functionally, it's the same. See, there are situations where indecision is in itself decisive because you're choosing against the treatment for a problem that one person says you've got. Now, of course, let's say you went to not a quack doctor, you went to two seriously respected doctors, they had different opinions. Well, you would have to try and find out who was right. But again, you couldn't be agnostic. So what you would do is you'd maybe go and see a third doctor or look into the medical credentials of these people who are diagnosing you or ask if you can see the x-rays yourself or get a second opinion or you do something to find out. So there might be more investigation needed, but you certainly wouldn't say, who cares who's right? I don't need to decide. I don't want to decide who's right because there isn't a neutral position. If this is true, you've got to take action. If it's not true, then you can sit back. But there isn't a middle way between the two. And John says, the message I got from God is that there's a problem. God is light, and you're not, then you can't be friends. If God is light and you're not, then on Judgment Day, when you meet him, the light is going to destroy the darkness. Yet there is a wonderful solution. You turn to him, confess your sins, trust in him, you can be cleansed. And John, again, is sure about this, but he's happy as well as sure. In some ways it's bad news, isn't it? There's a problem. I think that's only realism, actually, in the world we live in. If anyone comes up to me and says, in my society, I genuinely believe that humans are basically good, I think, how naive could you be? Just read the newspapers any day, not in the Middle East, appalling things happening in the Middle East, but close to home as well, in most families, most years, appalling things happen. One of my friends is a social worker, and some of the things that happen just a few miles from me, honestly, would make you sick. So to say, oh, I think everything's basically okay, I think that's extraordinary to think that. I think everyone knows there's a problem. But John's joy comes from the fact that he knows a solution, a God who loves us. A God who wants fellowship with us, friendship with us. A God who's given his son as a sacrifice so that we could be forgiven. But for John, this isn't a philosophy. It's not just a hunch or an opinion or a particular cultural lifestyle. It's something about which he's very sure because he met him. He saw him. He touched him. he's got the evidence that persuades him that there's no need to be uncertain about it. Well, as I close, I wonder which kind of agnostic you are. Maybe you're agnostic in sense one. I just haven't looked into it enough to know. It's okay. That's honest. But please do. It's important enough that you need to investigate it. Why not start with Mark's Gospel on your chair, with a John's Gospel in a bookshop, or find it online and read it and ask questions until you found out. Maybe you're agnostic in sense two. You don't think it's possible to know. I can't really sympathise with that position. I don't know how you could be so sure that you can't be sure. But I imagine quite likely there's people agnostic in sense three, playing the game to keep it at arm's length because you're afraid of engagement with something that might mess up your life. It won't mess up your life. But also, it's not safe to leave it. Please look into it. Thank you so much for your time.
Hi, so you mentioned your three forms of agnosticism. But you also said when you were talking about how, you know, whether we as Christians find life easier or not, you use the term we sort of proper Christians. So assuming there are people who call themselves Christians but perhaps haven't got the message right or whatever, is that another form of agnosticism or is it something different? And how would you sort of respond to them? What advice would you give to them?
Thank you. Yeah. So I'm sorry if that sounded like an arrogant phrase, proper Christians. So let me say, in some ways, it's a kind of autobiographical discovery. So I was a church goer for about 9 years. I started when I was nine, joined the church choir because my piano teacher was in the choir and recommended it, not from a particularly religious family, but I did the whole kind of choir boy thing, singing hymns, wearing a little frilly collar. I did all that kind of thing when I was a kid. And I don't think I ever really encountered Christianity during that whole time. So I got lots of the outward rituals of it. I heard many, many sermons, none of which I really paid any attention to. And it was when I went to university that I met Christians who kind of actually believed it and actually lived it out. So in my village, it was a kind of cultural thing. Nobody really took it seriously, including the vicar, actually. And we muddled through. And basically, I think my view of Christianity was it was about gullible hypocrites. And that sounds rude, but that's what I thought when I was 18. Because I'd never heard anyone give me a reason to take Jesus seriously. And I didn't know anybody who lived as if they actually cared what he said. And then when I went to university, I met some people who really did take it quite seriously. And it seemed to change the way they lived. I found that very interesting, intriguing. And they all thought it was true. And actually, it was only when I was at university that I made the discovery that Christianity was a historical question. I know it's obvious, you'll probably think typical Cambridge student to not realise that. But I genuinely thought it was just an aesthetic question. You know, am I into the experience that the Church of England can give you? And the answer was not really. You know, I quite liked singing when I was younger, but I wasn't really into it as an experience. Or I thought it was entirely an ethical question. You know, do I believe in Christian ethics? Which I thought I did when they overlapped with my ethics, and when they didn't, I just did my own ones. But I'd never realised it was a historical question and therefore an objective question. Who was this guy in history? What did he actually say? Forget the church politics of bishops and Church of England and whatever. Who was Jesus? What did he say? Was he God? If he was God, what does that mean? So that's what I mean by proper Christian, because I think I'd had a kind of cultural engagement with the religious kind of offshoots of the thing without ever really engaging with Jesus. And I just encourage you not to do the same. What was I for that period? Well, I don't know. I think I was you could say I was a functional atheist in that I lived as though there wasn't a God, but with a kind of cultural trappings of a Christian heritage, I suppose. But I wasn't a Christian, so it may be that someone like that here. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Cool. What would you say to someone who says that they need their own Thomas-type experience? So if someone said that, like hypothetically, if God existed and loved them, that God would reveal himself to them, but in the meantime, they just want to completely ignore that possibility until God like chooses to do that.
Sure, yeah. Well, I think personally I'd say that, you know, we've got to come to God and set the terms ourselves slightly misunderstands, I think, the relationship between us and God. He is the creator of the world and we are quite small creatures in the world. And I think that to say to God, look, here are the hoops that I've decided you have to jump through, There's a kind of arrogance that I think. So I don't think God owes us explanation on our terms. I think it's kind of him if he's given us explanation on his terms. So I think that's the first thing I say. And in fact, Jesus did encounter people with that kind of attitude. So some of the religious teachers of the day asked him for a sign. And ironically, Jesus had given many signs. So there were many things that Jesus did in front of lots and lots of witnesses, which I think constitute very serious evidence. And some of them had seen those. But that wasn't enough because they said, no, we want a sign on our terms. So do a sign, Jesus, like jump through the hoop. And he says, no, I'm not going to do it because I'm not dancing to your tune. So that's, I think that's the first thing. But secondly, I think there's evidence that is there that we need to take seriously. So it's like a jury would say, like imagine, and this is absurd, but imagine a jury said, no, we'll only make a decision about this if he does the murder again, like in front of us in court now. It's just silly, because the question is, there is an objective claim with objective evidence already there, and that's the stuff you've got to engage with. So I think just to say the kind of evidence I would like is such and such, well, sorry, but you don't have that. However, here's the kind of evidence that there is. So I think just to kind of start with that. But secondly, I think the evidence that there is, again, I think it is strong evidence even for us today. And it's just we got to get used to having a kind of a testimony that's the intermediary between the facts and me. So something happened, somebody else saw it, and they've told me. And I think that's, again, that's normal in our legal system. And we just got to get a bit used to it. You can believe things somebody else tells you if the other person is trustworthy. And in this case, the person who's telling us is somebody who themselves was there, who themselves were willing to suffer for this and proclaim it, who it seems to me didn't have much to gain by making it up. And I think we can be confident because they were confident. So I think, I'll say what I said before. I would push the question back to, you might be agnostic. Do you think the apostles were agnostic? Seems to me that none of them were at all agnostic. They were absolutely sure. Why were they absolutely sure? Because they saw it. Well, actually, if the people who saw it were sure, then I can be sure. Because they would know. They were in a position to know. So, yeah. Thank you.
Great. It's time for one or maybe two.
Sorry, you're encouraged to give very concise questions, and I'm allowing myself very waffly answers. I'll try and be concise as well.
Do you think it's incumbent upon Christians to explore other faiths as much as they explore their own?
Do you think Christians should explore other faiths as well as their own? I think it's a very helpful thing to do, especially in terms of speaking to people who hold those other faiths. So I've got a Hindu friend at the moment, and I know more about Hinduism now as a result of talking to him than I did a couple of years ago. I've read some of the Quran because it was useful. I think it's a useful thing to do. I don't think you need to do it to find out what's true, just for the reason that Jesus is a kind of true, false, falsifiable question. So if you look at, let's say you start with Jesus and you say, did he rise from the dead? Actually, it turns out he didn't. So, you know, Jesus was a con man and he faked it and people were taken in. And it is all a fabrication. Well, if that's the case, you write Christianity off, then definitely you need to look at some alternatives. Because if Christianity is a hoax, then who knows? Maybe there's truth in one of these other views that they're going around in the world. However, if you do it the other way around, you look at the resurrection of Jesus. Did it happen? Yes, he was really dead and was really alive again 3 days later. I think that must mean that he has supernatural power of the Creator. Who else could reverse the laws of biology like that? Well, in that case, I'm going to start taking what he says quite seriously, if this is God speaking. And then one of the things that Jesus says is, for example, God is light, in him there is no darkness at all. And I think, well, that's not what the Eastern religions say, so they must be wrong. Because if he's God and he knows, and he says this, and they say that, well, then they're incorrect. And you could go through comparing Jesus with many other philosophers. And you say he doesn't agree with them about this. Well, they must be wrong if he's from God. So I think if you start with Jesus and you falsify him, you need to look everywhere else. But if you start with Jesus and you find he's right, then you've ended your search. because God would know the truth about God. And if they have met God, then they know the truth.
Great, thank you. We have run out of time, I'm afraid. But
Can I say one more thing?
Yeah, please do.
Sorry, I know we've run out of time, I'll be quick. Just something I like to encourage people to do after talks like this, and you might not be up for it, I really would love you to read one of the historical documents for yourself. That's something I never did. I made up my mind about just Jesus without ever engaging with any of the historical material, and I'd love you not to do the same. Now, the deal I often offer my friends in London is, why don't you read one chapter of Mark's Gospel or John's Gospel, whatever it is, and you underline everything you don't understand, you tick everything you think is great, and you put a cross next to everything you find objectionable. And at the end of a chapter of doing that, I'll buy you a coffee, and we'll work through it, and you can tell me what you didn't understand, what you agree with, what you don't, and I'll tell you what I think as a Christian, and we can talk about it. And if it's useful to do that, then we can do another one or another coffee in chapter two, and if it's not very useful, we can leave it there. So you've got a maximum of, if you do Mark's Gospel, you've got a maximum of 16 coffees on your Christian friend, which will last you this term and next term, I guess. And just a chapter at a time, just looking at it. And at any stage, you can say, this isn't useful anymore, I want to stop. But what have you got to lose starting with chapter one? I haven't asked any of the Christians here if they're up for it, but I imagine they probably are, because they want you to look into this. They probably buy you a coffee. So try that out. Thank you.